Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Evolution, What Everyone Needs to Know, by Robin Dunbar. Narrated by Bruce Mann. Preface. In the last paragraph of his book, On the Origin of Species, Charles Darwin referred to life on Earth as an entangled bank. A collection of different species whose lives are complexly intertwined, sometimes competing, sometimes interdependent, sometimes cooperating. Of course, not that long ago, the tangled bank of nature was a great deal richer in its plants and wildlife than it is now, thanks mainly to what we have done to it in a frighteningly short span of time. But that's another story. For now, the more important point is that our planet is still amazingly rich, teeming with life forms that exist in some remarkably complex relationships, both with one another and with the physical planet itself. It might even be the richest planet in the universe, or at least so we often like to think. But even if there are other planets elsewhere that are just as rich, or even richer, the very fact that it is as rich as it is should excite our curiosity and demand an explanation. How on earth did it come to be like this? After 2 centuries of intensive scientific effort, we now have the luxury of a theory that provides a general explanation for that richness, often in quite considerable detail. That theory, Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection, is famous for 2 reasons. One is that it is the 2nd most successful theory in the history of science, after quantum theory in physics, in terms of its ability both to explain what we see in the natural world and to stimulate new ideas and research that have uncovered rich seams of novel findings. The 2nd has been its ability, as a theory, to provide a unifying framework for a disparate array of disciplines that do not always see themselves as natural allies. That array includes not just the various life sciences, ecology, genetics, anatomy, physiology, biochemistry and animal behavior, but also hard sciences like chemistry, the softer sciences like medicine, sociology, anthropology and economics, and even the humanities. History, linguistics and literature all fall under the purview of evolutionary theory. At the same time, the theory of evolution is perhaps the most widely misunderstood theory in the whole of science. Ironically, it is sometimes misunderstood even by other scientists as much as by laypeople. Of course, the theory we have now is not just Darwin's original theory. That theory has been much developed and extended, to the point where Darwin himself would not recognize large parts of the modern theory as his own, though he might well be intrigued and impressed by it. Nonetheless, everything in the modern theory derives from Darwin's original insights. My own interest in evolution stems from an unusually early introduction. When I was aged about 11 and living in Africa, my grandmother in California, a retired surgeon with a deep interest in the natural world but equally deep religious views, used to send me the Audubon Society's sticker books for children. I confess that my eyes tended to glaze over with the ones on the desert plants of the American Southwest or the natural wonders of the world, but I found the one on evolution especially captivating, not least because it dealt with the whole of our planet's history, with sections on the dinosaurs as well as human evolution. I have no doubt that this small evolutionary moment of grand parental solicitude probably did more than anything else to encourage me to become interested many years later, both in human evolution and wildlife biology, and, in due course, to be willing to spend many hours watching animals, as well as humans, in the wild. The combination of the pleasure that derives from watching other species at their everyday work, and the curiosity to ask why and how they come to be as they are and do what they do are both rewards in themselves and the principal drivers of curious inquiry. Although the theory of evolution itself is elegantly simple, something that all theories in science aspire to be, applying it in a multi-dimensional substrate like the biological world results in the generation of extraordinary complexity, rather as the ripples on a pond spread beyond the point where the stone lands. This is a consequence of the fact that evolutionary processes are embedded in the physics and chemistry of the planet, and the ways these interact with physiological and cellular processes, as well as with the cognitive and behavioral machinery that is made possible by the evolution of large brains. I like to think that evolutionary biologists sit in front of an enormous jigsaw puzzle whose myriad bits at first seem chaotic and completely unrelated to each other. But, as the picture is gradually assembled, something emerges that is both coherent and magical in the way the pieces slot into place. The best science is always about that, "I would never have thought that," response, as the mists of our confusion clear and all is revealed. This book does not particularly seek to justify the theory of evolution or prove that it is true. I take that largely as read. In any case, there are plenty of books that do that already, not least among them Jerry Coyne's recent volume, Why Evolution is True. Instead, I want to take a much broader view than most books on evolution would take. I want to show that if we keep asking, "But why is this the case?" Darwin's ideas turn out to have implications for every aspect of life on Earth, including every aspect of human behavior. In doing so, I build on many decades of research in a very wide range of disciplines. I will try to show how the jigsaw of disciplines articulates in ways that support and reinforce Darwin's original insights, creating a satisfying sense of completeness. Perhaps more than anything else, though, my concern will be with the importance of asking the right questions. Too often, misunderstandings about evolutionary theory and its implications for human behavior arise out of a failure to understand exactly what it is that evolutionary theory actually entails. Nothing could illustrate this better than the bizarre socio-biology wars of the 1970s, when the first faltering attempts to apply evolutionary theory in a serious way to human behavior provoked a ferociously defensive backlash from social scientists and the humanities, most of whom seldom took the trouble to find out exactly what was being suggested, let alone read a book on evolution. We have moved on, but I continue to be surprised by the frequency with which the same errors and misunderstandings reappear in different guises and reflect a continuing failure to engage with the theory. This book, then, tries to set out exactly what the theory of evolution entails. Most books on evolution, including those childhood Audubon books, deal only with conventional topics like species evolution, the questions Darwin himself had started with, namely, how do new species arise, and why do some go extinct? I want to follow Darwin in his later, in many ways more interesting, explorations of the evolution of behavior, emotions, psychology, and sociology. As Darwin recognized, his theory of evolution has far-reaching implications for every aspect of life, and almost every other discipline in the academy. That inevitably takes us beyond what animals are to what they do, and so eventually to the human condition itself in all its many varied aspects. What the theory of evolution offers us is the greatest story ever told, how we and all the other creatures with whom we share the planet came to be, why we are not all the same, and how and why we are all so interdependent. One of the important messages that an evolutionary approach gives us, and that I really want to emphasize, is that the biological world is a complex, integrated system, not a set of unrelated causes and their unitary effects. Everything an organism chooses to do or become has consequences that reverberate throughout its biology and even beyond into the biology of other species. Everything we, or any other animal or plant, choose to do has consequences for the evolution of every other member of our species, and for every other species, even every ecosystem that our actions impact on, as conservationists have been reminding us with increasing alarm. In some cases, a consequence may throw up constraints that are so severe or so costly to overcome that evolution along these lines is simply impossible. There is, as the behavioral ecologist Nick Davies once remarked, no way butterflies would ever evolve machine guns, no matter how advantageous these would be in their sometimes spectacular aerial battles for territories. Flight and a miniature body size simply rule out anything like that. But even practical innovations will have consequences that the animal will need to address. Growing a larger brain so as to affect smarter solutions to the business of everyday survival means that you will need to forage more, because brains are 10 times more costly to maintain than muscle. That in turn will expose you to higher levels of predation risk. A solution to a problem very quickly becomes another problem that also has to be solved. In evolutionary analyses, we forget this at our peril. Evolution is also about serendipity. Casual circumstance often triggers a direction that could never have been anticipated, the law of unintended evolutionary consequences. One example close to home was, as we shall hear later, the adoption of bipedalism by our earliest hominin ancestors 6 or 7 million years ago. This made it possible for speech to evolve some 6 million years later. Neither our ancestors nor evolution intended this consequence, but it was an opportunity that was, at the right moment, there for the taking. Though it did, as we shall hear, require some other serendipitous and quite unrelated adaptations along the way. Had our distant ancestors not been pushed down this road, it is very unlikely that human language and all that followed from that would ever have evolved. I would not have been able to write this book, and you would not be listening to it. In telling this story, I have structured the book as a conversation that builds progressively, as a conversation might. The key to it, as to all science, is the child's persistent asking in response to every answer, but why? The 10 chapters identify 10 major topic areas that progressively narrow the focus down from evolution in the abstract to human cultural behavior in particular. I want to show how, by simply asking why, we are taken inexorably down into every corner of life. I have necessarily been somewhat selective in my topic choices, but then so has every book on evolution. My choices have been dictated mainly by the way key parts of the story build progressively into a coherent explanation for much of what we, as humans, are, do, and experience. Humans as just another species, but one that, for better or worse, we happen to have a particular interest in. Above all, though, I want to convey the sense that science, difficult as it sometimes can be, is enormous fun, not least because it can often surprise us in a way that our folk beliefs seldom do, because they rarely invite us to be curious about the world out there. It is a story that never ceases to amaze and intrigue, and that, like all the best stories, never seems to pall in the retelling. Indeed, in many ways, science is one of the pinnacles of human storytelling, and the theory of evolution is one of its best examples. I should add, just to be clear, that I will often speak of animals intending to pursue particular evolutionary strategies, or of genes promoting their own self-interest. This does not imply that either genes or animals, or indeed humans sometimes, are conscious of what they are doing, or even that they are intending to act in a particular way. This is simply a convention in evolutionary biology, which derives from the fact that natural selection acts as if, in a metaphorical sense, it was selecting for animals to behave in a teleological manner. One could, if so minded, rephrase everything in a much more precise way, but it would inevitably be long-winded and make for a very dull story. In science, nothing is gained by making things more complicated than necessary, not least because the human mind is not designed to handle complexity. 1. Evolution and Natural Selection. 1. Why do we need a theory of evolution? We live in a world of immense diversity. There are around 5,500 species of mammals and some 10,000 species of birds. But even that pales into insignificance beside the 12,000 species of roundworms, about half of whom are parasites, the ascarids, hookworms, pinworms, and whipworms that play havoc with human health all around the world. And these in turn are dwarfed by the 91,000 species of insects that we currently know about, never mind an estimated similar number that we haven't yet identified. And we haven't even considered the 250,000 species of beetles. As the great English evolutionary biologist J.B.S. Haldane once observed, if God exists, he must be inordinately fond of beetles. On top of that, you can add around 250,000 species of plants, and we haven't got on to the bacteria and viruses yet. Most of the time, we take all this extraordinary diversity for granted, hardly noticing it as we go about our daily lives. Typically, we are only interested in species that cause diseases, are a nuisance in our gardens, or appear on our dinner plates. The numbers that fall into these categories are so small as to be insignificant. Most of us eat no more than 100 species of animals and plants combined, and many a good deal fewer than this. Given that we share our world with so many species, it should give us pause to wonder how they, and we, came to be. It is easy to look at the world as it is now and imagine that this is how it has always been. Even the great Greek philosopher-scientist Aristotle, 384 to 322 BC, assumed the world had always been as he found it, despite being, by a clear head and shoulders, by far the greatest biologist before Darwin. Even so, we are left with a puzzle. Why are there so many different forms of life? Why should there be so many species of beetles, so many birds, so many different plants? On the Noah's Ark principle, wouldn't one species of beetle be enough? The very fact that there are hundreds of thousands of different forms of life raises another important question. Why are some of these life forms beneficial for us? For example, the ones we eat or those that coexist happily with us? Whereas others, such as the many species of predators and parasites, are decidedly detrimental to our health and even our very survival. The answer to all these questions lies in Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection. The great Ukrainian-American evolutionary biologist Theodosius Dobzhansky, himself a devout Orthodox Christian, famously remarked, "Nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution." He might have said, "Nothing in life," because Dobzhansky's dictum, as this is now known, applies as much to the human sciences, psychology, sociology, economics, history, archaeology, and almost any other discipline you care to name, as it does to the biological world. Everything in our world has evolved, just as the solar system and the universe itself have evolved. Nothing, not even the universe, has remained in a stable state since the beginning of time. Everything has a history dominated by change with the progression of time. That is all that evolution means. But this raises one more question. Is that change simply the natural unfolding of an internal process of some kind, or is it the consequence of some kind of external force? No one doubts that the evolution of the universe is of the first kind. Early theories of biological evolution dating back to the ancient Greek philosopher-scientists also assumed the first, but Darwin insisted that it was the second. The question we have to ask is, how is it that we have ended up with the biological and psychological world as we now experience it? And how does this impinge on us as a species and on our behavior? 2. So who discovered evolution? The great classical and medieval philosopher-scientists accepted that various life forms differed in terms of their skills and abilities, a view first set out by Aristotle around 350 BC. Building on Aristotle, the Christian theologians of the early medieval period developed an implicit theory of evolution, known as the Great Chain of Being. At the top of the chain was God, with his angels on the rung immediately below him, and then, on the rung below that, humans, who, everyone agreed, are the most advanced form of life on earth. And then on down, rung by rung, through the various mammals, birds, reptiles, and fishes, to the bugs and creepy crawlies that represent the least developed forms of life. It was easy to view this as a static hierarchy, fixed in time by an act of creation. However, during the 1600s, people began to wonder about some of the rocks that farmers occasionally dug up when ploughing their fields. They were clearly rocks, but advances in medical science, especially anatomy, made it obvious that these rocks looked suspiciously like bones. In 1667, the Danish priest and scientist Nicholas Steno, or Niels Stensen in the original Danish, argued that they must be the bones of long-dead creatures that had become rock-like through the absorption of minerals while in the ground. This surprising suggestion raised the possibility that species might not live forever, that some species might go extinct. That realization sowed the seeds of the idea that life forms might evolve and change over time. Trying to explain how this happens, however, proved to be a challenge. Many zoologists during the 1700s and early 1800s made suggestions. The most successful of these theories was that proposed in 1809 by the most eminent of all the French zoologists, Jean-Baptiste de Monet, the Chevalier de Lamarck, or plain Lamarck, as he is now usually known. Lamarck supposed that species were constantly being created anew, even now, this very minute, right now. Each of these new species then evolved along the same set path, the great chain of being. Everyone begins as a tiny bug of some kind and gradually works their way up the great chain until, eventually, everyone presumably becomes human. It was never quite clear whether we as a species would one day become angels, or whether it meant that new human species could evolve while we were still around. One important implication was that the species that have been around longest are the most advanced, because they have had the most time to work their way up the great chain. This implied that humans, being obviously the most complex species, must have been around the longest, notwithstanding the clearly stated fact in the Bible that Adam and Eve had in fact been created after all the other beasts of the field. Awkward, but something that everyone seemingly chose to ignore. Though these views owed as much to armchair philosophizing as real empirical zoology, the Lamarckians in fact had good experimental evidence to support their view. The experiment was deceptively simple. Take a bucket of water from a pump, check it carefully under a microscope, and you'll see nothing but pure water. Leave the bucket to stand for a few weeks and check it again, and lo and behold, you will find it teeming with microscopic life. Here was startling evidence that life was constantly and spontaneously being created anew every minute of the day. It was an ingenious experiment. Its only flaw was that knowledge about germs and bacteria was still a century away in the future. The newly created life was, of course, coming in from the surrounding air, which, as we now know, is full of microscopic life blown hither and thither on the wind. Meanwhile, in Britain, a number of amateur naturalists had also been promoting evolutionary views. These included Erasmus Darwin, Charles Darwin's grandfather, the Edinburgh publisher Robert Chambers, and the Scottish farmer and founding father of geology, James Hutton, who proposed something that was remarkably close to Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection. Darwin likely came across these views when he was a medical student at Edinburgh, before he gave that up in favour of becoming a theology student at Cambridge, with a view, at his father's exasperated behest, to becoming an Anglican parson. 3. How did Darwin's theory change our understanding of evolution? In 1831, a very young Charles Darwin, he was just 22 at the time, was offered the opportunity to accompany an equally young captain, Robert Fitzroy, he was just 26, on a 5-year round-the-world voyage on the Royal Navy's survey vessel HMS Beagle, to survey the coasts of South America and the Pacific Islands as far as Australia. The purpose of this lengthy voyage was to improve the quality of the Royal Navy's shoreline maps. Darwin's role was very simple. It was simply to be Fitzroy's companion on the voyage, so that the young captain had someone of his own intellectual standing to talk to on what would otherwise be a very long, lonely trip. But, being already an experienced geologist, Darwin was soon appointed to be the expedition's geologist. In fact, he spent much of his time undertaking long horseback rides into the hinterland at every stop, as an escape from the boredom of shipboard life. During these expeditions, he collected the fossil bones of extinct giant South American mammals, as well as specimens of the many new living species of insects, birds, and mammals that he encountered. The similarities and differences between the species he collected in different places caused Darwin to spend the next 25 years grappling with how some of these species, and especially those on neighboring islands, could be so different, yet so obviously related. Eventually, in November 1859, he published his groundbreaking book on the origin of species by means of natural
sample complete. Ready to continue?